You're listening to KHEN, LPFM Radio, 106.9, Salida, Colorado, community-supported radio, and we're streamed on the Internet at khen.org. And if you'd like to listen to tonight's program or any past programs of Truth Quest, they are now available at www.givemesometruth.info or linked from khen.org website. And I'm Melody, and my co-host this evening is Dr. Eric Carlstrom, and our special guest tonight is Joan Bion. And up until September of 94, Joan Bion was just a businesswoman, and as a result of attending the United Nations Conference on Population and Development in Cairo, Egypt, she received her wake-up call, and as she found, there was more going on at the global level than most Americans knew, understood, or were being told. And in her determination to understand the global level and what really means for Americans, Joan has covered over 91 UN and UN-related conferences since Cairo, which isn't it close to 100 now, Joan?
Yes.
Okay, which include the economic, political, and environmental, military, peacekeeping, legal, trade, and financial. They include eight, group of seven, now eight, six, group of seven finance ministers meetings, four, group of eight foreign ministers meetings, the International Organization for Security Commissions, the Rio Plus Five Americas meetings, Bank for International Settlement meetings, Gorbachev State of the World Forums, various conferences at the UN, United Nations, the International Criminal Court, Al Gore's first global conference on reinventing government, two World Trade Organization meetings, and others. And Joan is credentialed through USA Radio Network in Dallas, Texas, and has appeared as a result on a guest on many programs. And she has asked questions and interviewed presidents and prime ministers, key United Nations, IMF, World Bank officials, Bank for International Settlement officials, Bank of England officials, high officials throughout the Clinton and Bush administrations, multinational, transnational CEOs, and many others to understand the global agenda and how it relates to you and I living on the local level. So I'll go ahead, and if there's anything more there that you would like to add to that, Joan, please feel free.
Well, I realize how much I need to update it, but there's been a lot of different conferences in addition to the ones you read, and it's not important. The fact is that God has opened doors to me at the highest level of world powers, and it's been amazing to me, but I've walked in and through, and I have done what I felt the Holy Spirit led me to do at the time, and that is to understand a very evil agenda of world government, enslavement, and control.
And Dr. Carlstrom, do you have anything you'd like to address with Joan?
Well, yes, it's certainly an honor and a privilege and a pleasure to be able to talk with you, Joan. As I was mentioning earlier, on Tuesday I ordered one of your DVDs called The World Government Connection, which I got just by getting information online, which is your website is www.womensgroup.org. And I got this video, and I've watched most of it. It's very fascinating. It says that you calculate that there must be something like 5,000 meetings a year that this group of globalists conducts, which would mean, on average, over 118 meetings a day. Now, most of us, as you point out in your video, are busy living our lives and trying to make the best of our lives. But there is a small group that has another purpose, it would seem, and very, very well organized. And I think the reason we're so glad to talk to you is that you know a lot about what the rest of us know almost nothing about. I'm a 59-year-old college professor, and a lot of this comes as news to me, although I've been investigating this stuff over the last few years since 9-1-1. So we had talked just a little bit earlier about 9-1-1, and the reason I'm interested, I know you can perhaps give us some insight into the larger context, into the 9-1-1 operation, as I'm calling it, Operation 9-1-1. What would be your take on the reasons why we had Operation 9-1-1?
Well, that's not a small question, so I'm going to break it down. Before we get to 911 specifically, I wish to give some background. I'm one of these people, I'm a globalist in my thinking only. Globalist meaning I have to paint the forest before I can get to the tree. When I woke up in 1994, it was as a result of reading a book called Euroquake. And that was a business book that came out in 1990. I happened to see it in Borders or one of the other major bookstores. And I was very fascinated because the author, who was a New York Times columnist, etc., wrote that he had interviewed, and he had 4.5 pages of very impressive people that he had interviewed. A number of years later, I've interviewed the same types of people, the CEOs, the world leaders, UN Secretary Generals, presidents and prime ministers, etc., economists, you name it. I've interviewed quite a few people and a very wide range of people as well. In any event, they provided him over a year's time ideas and things that they felt they saw coming in the 90s. And as I started reading his 100 predictions for the 1990s, one of his ideas that he was looking for, he wrote, by the end of the 1990s, the dollar, the Deutschmark, now replaced by the euro, and the yen would be equal to one. And this was 1990, and I was very struck by the fact that he was describing a world currency. And I'm like, a world currency? You don't have a world currency unless you have world government, because that's the whole purpose of currency. And as I started to pray about it, because I didn't know, where would I find world government? I didn't have a clue. At that time in 1990, 1994, even 1998, and up to almost 2000, you never really heard that much about the United Nations. It was hardly referred to in the news. Occasionally you saw a picture of George Bush or somebody giving a speech at the United Nations, but really that was it. There was very, very little for people to understand as far as the activities going on the international level. And so I began to pray about, Lord, show me, where's world government? Do we have world government today? Where will I find it? What kind of structure? In 1994, I was challenged to go to Cairo by a lady friend who was an ardent pro-lifer, and she explained to me that the agenda for this meeting by the United Nations, whoever they were, in Cairo, was to reduce the population of the earth. Well, I'm a businesswoman, and that wasn't part of my thinking on a daily basis. Yes, I'm a pro-lifer, but, you know, that's not my thing specifically. And I told her, no, I wasn't going. And I told her, in fact, about 15 times I wasn't going. And then I got very stern and told her not to ask me again because our friendship would be ruined. And then God got a hold of me, and the short of the story is that I went. I went for a look-see. I was going to go in. I was going to go out. Okay, Lord, whatever you want to show me, that's fine. And I was not prepared for what I saw, because I saw world government in action at the international level through the United Nations and the World Bank and the IMF and a whole host of other organizations, commissions, and agencies of the United Nations that I was not even familiar with. I had my wake-up call. There were 25,000 people in Cairo. There were 5,000 of the 25. 5,000 were delegates from countries all over the world to discuss this agenda. And the other 20,000 were divided about maybe 1,500 to 2,000 reporters, and the rest were non-governmental organizations. Well, I didn't even know what an NGO was, but they are basically, you know, non-profit groups, sort of like a church without the religious bent, but they do have their own religion. It's called Gaia, the worship of Mother Earth, the environmental agenda. And that's what was proposed 2 years earlier by the United Nations at the what is now dubbed the Rio Earth Summit. And Agenda 21, in essence, is, and I can say it in these terms, but it's taken me years to be able to articulate exactly what it is. Agenda 21 is a very radical environmental agenda for the Earth. And here we are in 2008, 14 years after the Rio Earth Summit in 1992, and all we hear now is green. Green cars, green this, green windows, green houses. In fact, I went to a very high-level meeting at Chatham House, the Royal Institute for International Affairs, last year in Britain, and they were doing a 14-year, whatever it was, recap of the Rio Earth Summit. And I was shocked. I expected something a little different from what they produced. And basically, it was all about how you can make gold out of green. Well, back in 1992, the Earth Summit, the environment, you and I are the culprits. We, you and me, are destroying planet Earth. And what they did was they perverted Genesis 1 through Agenda 21. They perverted it. They made, instead of man being dominant over the Earth, they made Earth dominant over man. Well, okay, so that was 1992, and then the follow-up in 1994. There I saw world government. I came home with a suitcase full of material. These NGOs were very well-versed. They were on board with an agenda that most Americans couldn't even fathom, and even today when I tell people about it, their eyes glaze over, they look at me like I'm a mad woman, and they want to run as fast as they can. But on the international level, the things that we're going to talk about today are common knowledge. They talk about world government, they talk about a global currency, they talk about a global tax, they talk about many different things that constitute the various facets of world government. And what world government really means is that the world is interconnected and there are no barriers or borders between the nations. And that brings me now to answering your question. So let's talk about the fact that one of the things that I discovered early on as I started studying the international infrastructure was that all the major walls, all the major barriers between the countries of the world have been torn down one by one over a period of time. The first barrier was money, finance. And that was torn down in 1944 when there was a major meeting in New Hampshire. And at a hotel in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, and they've dubbed the institutions that came out of that meeting the Bretton Woods institutions. The World Bank and the International Monetary Fund were set up there. And in essence, that is like a financial and economic United Nations. All the treasury secretaries from all the countries of the world meet at the IMF World Bank, and they are located in Washington, D.C., and for me, it's a breeze. It takes an hour to get to Washington, D.C. from where I live, and I can go cover various meetings. The other thing is that in 1945, the political barriers between the countries of the world were erased when the United Nations was set up. And as such, every country sends a representative to the United Nations, and there they meet on a continual, constant level of meetings and agendas and ideas and concepts that in which they are creating an international level of government, and they have done so since 1945. So the political barriers between the nation states started to fall in 1945. There are many other facets, but I'm going to fast forward to 1994 when the United States government, which was very reticent in the 1920s to put in place both the League of Nations and a world trade type of organization, approved something called the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs, known as GATT. That was approved in 1994 by a lame duck Congress, and Clinton was in the process of becoming president, and as such, it was the Republicans through people like Rush Limbaugh who were responsible for passing the WTO, the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs, which birthed a global world trade organization. And I remember being a very staunch Republican at the time, and all my Republican friends would say to me, Joan, what's wrong with the WTO? Rush says free trade is good for America. Well, Satan has always used lies, deceit, deception, and distortion, and that was just one of his many strategies to get us to tear down the trade barriers. In 1998, I was privileged to go to the founding meeting of the International Criminal Court. It was about 2 weeks long. I couldn't go to the, or maybe 3 weeks, I forget. I could only go to 1 week, which was the last week when it was officially set up and quote-unquote voted into existence by the countries of the world, the legal authorities, the attorney generals of the countries of the world. So the legal barriers were torn down. As I analyzed how all these barriers had fallen, I realized that that there were still some sensitive barriers that needed to fall, the military and the intelligence. In 1998, we had Y2K, and, you know, Y2K, I can just tell you that was a ruse as well, a global ruse. And they perfected in 1998 through Y2K how to pull, literally, the wool over the eyes of the people of the world. What was Y2K after all was said and done? Y2K was the wiring of all the countries of the world into an electronic form of world government, media, and communication. Okay, so one more step. 9/11. I was pretty shocked by 9/11, and my sister called me, and I remember watching the first building had already come down, and as I watched the second building and I watched the plane, I realized that was not a terrorist attack. It was on purpose. There was a real reason for it. What I did not want to conclude about Y2K was that it was planned and managed and on purpose. And I spent, they're on my website, I have 70 pages of abstracts from 9/11. I went through all the major media, and I, whenever I'm going to write, I do abstracts, and I gather data from all kinds of newspapers, and I use newspapers, magazines, TV, whatever the case may be. I use that information. I do abstracts so I can put in bite-sized morsels key salient points and where it came from. And as I went through 4 months of arduous research on 9/11, I was struck with the fact that the whole purpose of 9/11 was to tear down the two last remaining barriers, and that was the military and the intelligence. I had seen by covering the Group of Seven, and then after they admitted Russia, the Group of Eight heads of state meetings over throughout the 90s and up to that point. I had seen and I knew that they were working on something they called, I think it was the P-41 points. And what that was, it meant political 41. 41 points. And it all dealt, all those points dealt with creating on the international level like a global intelligence network where the KGB and the CIA and the FBI and M1 and Britain and Israel, whatever, they would all work together and they would share data. And over the years since 9/11, there now is a working center on the for intelligence in France. I think I'm pretty sure it's France. I'm sorry, it's Italy, Turin, Italy, and that was set up with the Nobel Peace Prize money that Kofi Annan got when he won the Nobel Peace Prize several years ago. That helped fund it. So what I saw from 9/11, that its sole purpose was, in my opinion, to finish the integration of all the countries of the world into an interdependent world. And if you will listen to the news, George Bush, or you listen to CNBC, they will talk about an interdependent world and a global trade system and a global economy and a You know, it's all one. It's all integration. And from that, people should know or understand that world government is not coming. And that's been my message pretty much from the beginning when I understood what the United Nations was, that the United Nations is the organizing principle of world government. I know there's a lot to talk about, but let me just say here that I was not looking for some of the other understandings that I believe God has given me. So, okay, exactly who is the power behind the United Nations? And furthermore, my research and my first book, Prince Charles, the Sustainable Prince, as I was working through material on Prince Charles, there was a complete blackout on him and his activities. And I can tell you that I brought to light on the international level the fact that, quote-unquote, we the common people knew that Prince Charles was a major power player behind the scenes, setting up public-private partnerships, which is fascism and a complete change in our governmental structure and a complete change in the governmental structure worldwide. And he was also very instrumental in supporting not only the whole environmental agenda, but part of the concept for Agenda 21 is something called sustainable development, which includes many things, but the key is to reduce the population of the world. As such, when I started seeing the role of Prince Charles, I realized as I was writing that book that it was the British royal family as the major power behind the United Nations to bring all countries under their sovereign rule. Now, that was in 1996, maybe 1997, I don't recall, that I came to that knowledge and understanding. It was not until I covered the World Trade Organization meeting in Cancun, I think it was either 2002 or 2004, that God gave me the understanding that the British control the votes at the United Nations through the Commonwealth, and I usually call it the British Commonwealth, but the official title is the Commonwealth. But Britain at the United Nations, indirectly through all of its former colonies that they say they gave independence to, but they didn't. They just tied them up a different way through the Commonwealth. They enjoy 54 votes or the potential of 54 votes while America has one vote. And at all the various United Nations agencies and organs, it's the same thing. The U.S. is terribly outvoted. So, 9/11, yes. 9/11, there are other facets to 9/11, such as control and taking away all privacy that we have or our rights to privacy, making us sort of like chattel or a bunch of cows, if you will. I think that's politically correct or incorrect. I mean, you know, they say that the cows, when they breathe, they cause carbon dioxide, and that's part of global warming. All of this is a ruse. This is the Garden of Eden all over again, and the people of the world have bit the apple real hard this time.
You know, this brings the issue up of the way we're treated in airports now, which is something I haven't talked to anybody about on this show, but I'm sure you fly around a little bit, and I'm sure you've noticed the police state type tactics that are being used. So you would say 911 was just kind of a phony catalyst to get Americans used to being herded around like cattle and treated with no respect and treated as if they didn't have individual rights. Would you say that?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I am appalled. I'm appalled. I had an incident when I was first flying to Mexico for treatment, for cancer treatment, this past December. And we were at Dulles, and I thought I could bring through all my nutraceutical supplements, and I had some very expensive things that I had been I paid a whole lot of money for, but in any event, that I thought would be safer if I just brought them with me through security. Well, did I get a wake-up call? And I got hysterical because I realized the magnitude of what they were doing and saying. And this particular security guard told my husband to calm me down because if he didn't get me under control, he would call the police. And my husband would not like what they would do to me.
Yeah, well, it's amazing, and I feel like the few times I've flown since 9-1-1, and I see this charade that's being carried out on the people, and I see Americans acting like, you know, docile sheep and cattle, I feel like screaming, you know, 9-1-1 was an inside job, you guys, you know, wake up.
Yes.
But, of course, the fact that there's so many uniformed people with guns around usually keeps me from doing that, but it obviously is another ruse.
Well, if you say anything, I don't know if you have, but I have friends who have, and they have been told that their attitude is incorrect. You know?
Well, let's talk a little bit. One of the great points that you make in your DVD is the fundamental difference between the U.S. Constitution and the U.N. Charter in the rights of individuals. And one of the reasons I think your work is so important is to help wake people up to the fact that, you know, the entire worldview that we grew up in is threatened by this new series of regional governance structures because it would remove our civil liberties.
Oh, entirely. Absolutely, entirely. People have no idea how contained the type of box that they've put us in so that we have very little movement. And when you go out of that box, you are now a threat to their new world order. And so far, we have the right to talk like we are on radio. And I just hope that the day never comes where we cannot do this any longer. But maybe it'll take that for Americans to understand if they can, because you mentioned that they are docile sheep. Yes, you know, we've been dumbed down very severely. You know, little kids who are overactive, in order to control them and to control the classroom, they're now told to get on Ritalin. I mean, this is very serious. And even before Ritalin, you know, the TV is a great... I mean, when I started covering global meetings, my mother said to me, "Are you sure that's what happened? I'm not hearing this on ABC or NBC. I'm not reading it." I'm like, "Mom, I'm your daughter. I was there. I heard it. Would I lie to you?" You know?
Joan, at any of these meetings, do they address the education system and the potential?
I'm sorry, Melanie. Let me break in for a second. I would like to make the point that I was trying to get Joan to make,
and since I just watched your video,
I'll briefly make it, which is that the U.S. Constitution says that our rights are from God, that they are inalienable, that they cannot be taken away. It gives us a republican form of government, and as in contrast to the U.N. Charter, which says rights are given and bestowed to the individual by the state. They can be taken away if that individual says something wrong or does something wrong. And it, of course, calls for world government. So it's a sea change in the role of the individual in the world. Now all of a sudden we can easily be reduced to serfs and slaves again.
Thank you. I was going to get there, but you did it much faster than I did. You're absolutely right. The scary thing when I realized that not only had they perverted Genesis 1 and made you and I equal to an animal, but now the difference between, you know, listen, when they set up the United Nations Charter and they met in San Francisco for 6 months, okay, and that's where the United Nations was birthed, and the bottom line is, why didn't they choose the U.S. Constitution, where our rights come from God? I mean, you know, we were the most successful country in the world. We all enjoyed freedoms beyond measure. Why didn't they choose our system? What is this that they chose a system whereby there's total control over the individual, like in communist China? People people aren't answering that question, and they're not asking it, because they don't even know the difference. And our Constitution and our freedoms are not taught today, so that our kids are literally walking zombies, and they'll never understand the slavery that they've been put into, because they never understood the freedoms that they were given or that they inherited through our forefathers.
And that goes back to the question I was going to address. Is at these meetings, what are they saying about the education system and where they're going with it?
Unfortunately, Melody, I cannot tell you specifically about the educational system, with the exception, because there are so many, Dr. Carlstrom mentioned. Now, that figure of 5,000 meetings a year, that's from 1995. I have no idea how many more meetings there are today, but if it's like inflation, you know, they're up to 9 or 10,000 meetings a year. And so the bottom line is that I have not specifically covered UNESCO, which is the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization. I have been to their headquarters in France, Paris, for other things, and I've purchased some books. But you see, part and parcel of what they want to do from an educational standpoint is completely change how we think, completely change our frame of reference, completely change our worldview, and completely change any kind of philosophy we have, which would include worshiping the God of the Bible and His Son, Jesus.
So essentially then, the education system is going to be gutted.
Oh, absolutely. It's in the process of being gutted now. One of the people that I did interview numerous times, his name was Dr. Robert Mueller. And Dr. Mueller is a globalist from way back. I interviewed him extensively on several occasions, and he had written about 5-6 books, and he had put together a global core curriculum, which is being taught in a number of schools throughout the United States. And his global core curriculum is all about how the world is our home, and how we are world citizens, and we are not citizens of the United States. And given that understanding, I would say to you that what has been coming out of England, and what I have noted, and I should have been keeping a log book over the years, but I did not. Many of the ideas that have surfaced regarding education, regarding the whole agenda of a world governmental structure, 9 out of 10 times come from Britain. And, you know, I can trace back to Britain. And so when you start taking a look at some of these ideas about a world governmental structure, you know, I can trace right back to Britain. And the bottom line is that they're all being taught and advocated at the United Nations.
Jones, you wrote a very interesting article that Melody sent on to me. It's called, I think you wrote it on July 4th, 2008. Mm. Is the 4th of July a ruse for we the people? And in this article, which is very provocative, and I think most people would be astonished and shocked to look at this article, you conclude the article by saying, is it possible, is it as possible as it looks that the entire global infrastructure comes from the Commission of Inquiry process and the Jay Treaty of 1796? In other words, we never broke with Britain, as they created other ways to keep us in the fold. Mm-hmm. Using multiple techniques, British created the international level of government they control. Gee, anyone? So I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about those things, the Jay Treaty, the Commission of Inquiry, the Law of the Sea, that you mentioned in that article.
The Jay Treaty, you know, it's very interesting. Our government signed the Jay Treaty, which basically you know, kept us under their thumb. A commission of inquiry is like a commission of informed people, or insiders, if you will, who always come together when there is a problem, because they're going to solve it. And all of the ideas and concepts that they end up coming up with end up being, if you will, moving us more deeply into world government than anything else. So it is true, you know, we've been, you know, and I said to a friend of mine who's done the bulk of the research on that, I said, you know, it would take a whole lot of digging for us to go through all of the various articles of incorporation for all the various United Nations treaties and then all of the United Nations organs and commissions because probably there was a commission of inquiry, and then it's based on the Dre Treaty. And the law of the sea, very clearly, I mean, this was shocking, refers back to the Jay Treaty. And you're not going to find it specifically in any area other than when you start looking at the legal documents. And so the law of the sea, the law of the sea is, otherwise the acronym is LOST, L-O-S-T, and I think that's a fabulous acronym because the United States has not yet, but it's almost a fait accompli, signed on to the law of the sea. It was Ronald Reagan who said, oh no, we're not going to do this. And, you know, it's gone in and out, and it's been to Congress a few more times, and one of these days it will be the law of the world. But the law of the sea is a very scary entity because when you start taking a look at what it is meant to do, it is really meant to take control of all the oceans. And let's not forget that Britain, quote-unquote, ruled the seas. And so here we have the law of the sea. I mean, this thing is fabulous. I mean, it is so diabolical. The law of the sea will establish, they will have an international seabed authority, and part of the international seabed authority, which will oversee the executive organ, which will be the council, the supreme organ, which will be the assembly, where they will elect members of the council and security secretary general, and they will elect the governmental board of the enterprise, which is the, I'll get to that in a second, and it's director general, but the enterprise that they wish to set up will be a whole commercial profit-making arm of the International Seabed Authority. And the enterprise will basically charge anybody who wants to mine or fish the oceans worldwide. So what has happened through the law of the sea is that the United Nations has basically raised a flag over the oceans like the early explorers did when they came to our hemisphere. And, you know, Cortez and Pizarro and you know, the Spanish and the Portuguese and the British and the Italians and anybody else who came to our hemisphere. And they came in the name of their king or the queen, and they took their flag of their country and they planted it, whether it was in the Bahamas or Florida or wherever, or Latin America. And they said, hey, this now belongs to the king of England or the queen of England or the king of France or whoever it was. You know, here, we found it. Well, the United Nations is basically doing that worldwide. And so every time they have a commission set up, and here we have the Law of the Sea Treaty, they're basically taking authority over, quote-unquote, what they've termed the global commons. The global commons, I'll never forget the first time I heard that. I almost fainted. I'm like, what other diabolical ideas will these people come up with? I mean, how many people do you know have taken control over the space and the space above a nation state, okay, and then you go into the outer hemisphere or whatever it is, outer space, okay? How many people, countries, whoever, have taken control over the rivers or the oceans that surround the countries of the world? That's what the United Nations has done effectively through the Law of the Sea Treaty. They now have become the, you know, the owner, if you will,
And again, who is the United Nations? In order to determine who the United Nations is, we need to know where the money comes, where their authority comes, who controls the United Nations, and who gets the most votes. And while the United States is paying the top dollar over all the other countries of the world, the bottom line is Britain gets the bottom line vote. And the rest
they have 54 votes. Yeah, when you consider
yeah.
all of their former colonies that have equally one vote in the UN. And if you trace it a little bit further, could we say that Great Britain itself, or the British Empire itself, is mostly controlled by the City of London and the financial institutions there? What used to be perhaps the British East Indies Company?
Oh, that's a fabulous question. You've done your homework. Absolutely. The the British East India Company, you know, it's very interesting. I'm just starting to, I've got about 3-4 books on the British East India Company, maybe 5, and I'm just starting to put together some other information that I wasn't aware of. And the British East India Trading Company was started by Elizabeth I, and it basically was a group of merchants from the city that she gave a charter and a license to quote-unquote, do free trade in all the other countries of the world. And they pretty much did it through barbarism, robbery, theft, all kinds of evil, lies, very, very nasty, very evil. Okay? Same way with the Bank of England. The Bank of England, and I've been to the city, and there's a fabulous book that we sell through the women's group called The City by E.N. Kuth. You really need to have that book. But in any event...
I think it's called Empire of the City, right?
Empire of the City. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it has to do with that 600 square miles inside the City of London proper, which is referred to as the city because it houses St. Paul's Cathedral, where Charles and Diana were married. It houses the temple, which is their whole legal system. It houses the London Stock Exchange. It houses the Bank of England. Okay? And the Bank of England is a private corporation like our Federal Reserve. It's a couple hundred years older than the Federal Reserve. And as I show in my video, thank you, Prince Edward. He basically showed the document where his great-great-great-grandfather, King William, and his grandmother, Queen Mary, he doesn't talk about Queen Mary, but King William signed on to become one of the first investors into the Bank of England. So, yes, the city. Now, I have a brand new video that's coming out. It's still in production. I'm waiting to get the final version of it, called 21st Century Feudalism. And in that video, I talk specifically about who controls the world. And in further research, I have concluded, right or wrong, but this is where my research has led me, that it is a financial, economic power play between the British royal family, because they have, outside of the chrysanthemum throne in Japan, they've been, quote-unquote, kings, queens, princes on this earth since about 800 A.D., and so when it is a marriage between the British royal family and the Rothschilds bringing additional money that the British royal family didn't have.
I certainly concur with your, I've been working on the same issues, and that seems very, good summary. We did have an interview last week with a guy named Jerry Smith, who's worked on weather modification and HAARP, and when we got to the same topic, his synopsis is, after many years of research also, is that the people that are actually running the world are the two groups, which he identified as the bankers and the watermelons. And the watermelons are, of course, green on the outside and red on the inside.
Yeah, well,
but you might enjoy that.
When you look at the watermelons, okay, that too goes back to the British, to the Rothschilds. And, you know, the international bankers financed the communist revolution, you know. And, very interesting times, isn't it?
Well, John, as far as you know, you're talking about the Law of the Sea Treaty and how the UN has tried to get a hold of the waters of the earth. Mm-hmm. Are they also not trying to get control of all the lands as well through things like heritage, heritage foundations? And
let's talk about that.
Okay.
The World Heritage Sites through UNESCO, which we talked about. UNESCO has one arm, which is in educational. When I was at UNESCO, it was because former congresswoman, now deceased, unfortunately, Helen Chenoweth, was going to go to a major World Heritage meeting at UNESCO. And she was going to go alone. And I was in Europe at the time at another UN meeting, and I flew over to Paris a couple days before she got there, and we didn't see each other, but I was there to check it all out. And there they were at this World Heritage meeting discussing, and it's all secret, new monuments that would be moved into the United Nations infrastructure. And I've done interviews with some of the key people who were responsible for the World Heritage legislation, which passed here in America under the Nixon regime, and they assure me that it has nothing to do with the United Nations controlling all these important World Heritage sites, whether it's a park or whether it's a monument or whether it's a house or whether it's the pyramids in Egypt or what have you. I beg to differ. But in any event, the United Nations is looking to control and take control over all the Earth's resources through various maneuvers. The law of the sea is the oceans. Here in the United States, our Congress passed a water initiative. I can't quite get the name.
Was it the Clean Water Act?
No, it wasn't the Clean Water Act. It was an initiative after the Clean...
Safe drinking water thing or something?
No. No, it had... I can't get it at this very moment, but what happened was they basically gave control of all of our rivers and our lakes here in America to a public-private partnership that has been set up to have control over all of our rivers, lakes, and streams here in America. It's a national thing, but I'm sure it'll be international. Then we have something that my state of Maryland was the first state to pass legislation on, something called Smart Growth, which actually was the United Nations Biological Diversity Treaty. And Smart Growth basically is a zoning law, and that comes out of the United Nations Habitat 2 meeting, which was held in Istanbul in 1996, and I was there. And Smart Growth does is that it is legislation to take control of where people can live. And so states are starting, and my state was one of the first ones, even though Oregon had been doing it for a number of years. Maryland was the first state to pass legislation that supported what came out of Agenda 21 from the 1992 Rio Earth Summit. And Smart Growth basically says that the state in the future will designate where people can live and where they can't live. And where they can live is where the state will pay for infrastructure, roads, schools, hospitals, and mass transit. Where the areas that are not growth areas will not get infrastructure support. Now, when you think about that, so what areas in all states in America, other than, let's say, the mountains of Colorado and the deserts of California and Arizona and New Mexico, what other land is there? It's farmland. And so Smart Growth does a number of things. Number one, it increases the value of property in the growth areas. It packs people in like sardines, where they can be easily controlled. In an interview I did with somebody back when I was at the Rio Earth Summit follow-up in 1997, what it does is it creates a high tax base so that all the environmental garbage can be implemented. You know, not one high-speed train or mass transit train has ever paid for itself, and yet that's what's on the docket in all the cities across America. I mean, this is a bankrupt America on top of its own bankruptcy agenda.
Could you mention a little bit about the North American Union as kind of an incremental step en route to this whole process?
Yes. I was reading the Washington Times back in 1995, and I just was flipping pages, and my eyes happened to see a very small article on the lower bottom of the page in the middle of the newspaper that said that Congressman Jack Kemp wanted a regional currency for all the Americas. I'm like, what? And that was my first tip-off that they were working on a free trade zone like you see with the European Union, which had been birthed but wasn't as developed as it is today. It's a couple steps ahead of America. And I started making some calls, and I started doing some research, and I found that they were going to have the follow-up meeting to the first meeting, which Al Gore chaired in Miami in 1994, in which Clinton and Gore had invited all of the heads of state from this entire hemisphere, with the exception of Cuba, to meet in Miami, where they would discuss common free trade goals. And I ended up going to the second meeting, and I think the third meeting, which was held in Canada. And there I started to understand that they were looking to put our hemisphere into its own free trade zone called the Free Trade Areas of the Americas. Well, interestingly enough, in 1992, our Congress had passed the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, which took effect January of 1994, 2 years later, and that was the first step to creating the free trade areas of the Americas, or our free trade zone, like the European Union. And so I started tracking that and writing on it. There was a complete blackout, and has been a complete blackout. I've written a couple of newsletters since then that talk about the North American Union. And one of the things that I could not understand is that in the early 90s, our Congress passed massive transportation bills. You know, we needed to fix the roads, and we needed to do this, and we needed to do that. Well, I never bothered reading them, or maybe I did, but I had too much on my plate. I couldn't really look at everything. And the bottom line is that a lot of the infrastructure by roads and railroad for the merger between the United States, Canada, and Mexico was done in the 90s, and it's in the process of being finished to the point where truly all that is needed is connector lines and connector rails between all the various points that have already been constructed that are sitting there waiting for the next step. The North American Union, one of the things that Carol Quigley wrote in his book, Tragedy and Hope, and let me just mention, Carol Quigley was an insider. He was Bill Clinton's mentor at Georgetown University. He wrote this book, Tragedy and Hope, I think it was 1965, talking about the real history behind the history that you and I are taught. And his book is very, very interesting and shocking and amazing. And I was very fortunate to get my hands on a very rare original print, a first print copy, back in 1975, when I started to understand something about a world governmental structure. But in any event, The bottom line is, Carol Quigley does not ever mention Fabian socialists or Fabian socialism. And so, you know, he's a very good resource, and I make this caveat. But in any event, Carol Quigley basically said that he thought world government was good, and, you know, it's a shame we have to do it, but socialism would be the mode. Now, the reason why I mentioned Carol Quigley is because you can read a lot about what he had to say about world government, and one of the things that he said was that the reason why Rome couldn't hold on to their world governmental structure is because it was too big. And so along the way, they came up with the idea that the best way to have a world governmental structure would be to have free, well, they didn't put it in these terms, but this is what it is, free trade zones. And within the free trade zone, what they would do is they would harmonize the laws between those countries, the currency, and how it functions, and giving it a parliament. And then later on, once all the various free trade zones were set up, then they would merge them into a world governmental system and a world with a world currency. And so there are a lot of things going on right now that are all working towards and pointing towards a world governmental structure.
You know, in your video, you actually have a great quote from Stalin, in which he says essentially what you just said, that you first have to do mergers of nations into regions because people will more likely accept that, and then finally you merge the regions into a single world dictatorship. So this was a plan that Stalin had. Now, could you explain the Stalin connection? Why would Stalin be on board with this plan that is now being carried out?
Well, that's a great question, and I'm not sure I can do it justice, but I would say to you that behind communism has been an experiment for how you control and take possession of a country, its people, its assets, and how you, quote-unquote, literally whip them into shape so that the state has total control. I was very surprised to find that quote from Stalin. I'm not an expert on Stalin, but he really was showing the steps that Carol Quigley had mentioned without really saying this is what's going to happen. You know, he just said, well, this is why, you know, Rome didn't last, and this is, if you're going to have a world governmental structure, this is what needs to be done. And then here is Stalin, well, you know, his book was, Quigley's book was written after Stalin, so, you know, it's very interesting. So where did Stalin get it? Well, Stalin was a puppet of somebody. The bankers, the royal family of Britain, I mean, you know, he was a puppet of someone. The concept, it came out of pure evil. Because when you control and you constrict, and there's no freedom, and actually, you know, really, communism is feudalism. All right? And when I look at Agenda 21, and when I look at the United Nations structure, over and over and over again, I see feudalism.
And that they also were going to utilize environment as their means to bring us together.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so what you have is Agenda 21, I believe it's a major feudalistic document for that whole very purpose.
One other thing, you interviewed Maurice Strong several times. What's his role in this?
Maurice Strong was a he was a puppet. Maurice Strong came from poverty, never got a college education. I can't remember at this moment if he did finish high school. He had very strong ties through family members to the Communist Party in Canada and worldwide at the time. He had an aunt who helped with the Russian Revolution and then went to China and helped there. And that was like an open door for him. He ended up meeting David Rockefeller, and he ended up working at the United Nations. And he was nominated, dubbed whatever, to become the first Secretary General at the first Earth Summit held in Stockholm in 1972. And so it was really Maurice Strong who has been the main front character or catalyst behind setting up the whole environmental agenda. And I met him at the Rio Earth Summit in 1997, and I started interviewing him at the World Bank, at the UN, at the World Economic Forum. I think I've interviewed him extensively, once in Washington, D.C., three or four times. But he was a major player. He still is a major, well, I don't know, he got caught with his hand in the till at the United Nations somewhere, and he's now in China, you know, creating his next $2 billion in wealth. But he's been a major catalyst at the United Nations. He set up United Nations Environment Program, UNEP, in Nairobi, Cairo. He was the first director of it. He has helped guide much of the radical environmental agenda. He is a friend of Prince Charles. That's what I learned from one of my interviews. He flew over on the Royal Jet from London. He was a director, and I say past tense, he still may be, a director of the World Wildlife Federation, which Prince Philip set up. That was one of the first radical environmental groups, again, London. Prince Philip has been, and Prince Bernard in Holland, the two of them have been major catalysts before Prince Charles matured and for setting up the foundation for environmental NGOs and the environmental agenda to be fed to the, you know, the world and unsuspecting people to get involved in saving the earth. And so,
well, yeah, I really appreciate the way you said that he was the main character behind selling out the entire environmental agenda. Because I've been an environmentalist, and it's only been in the last few years that I've begun to realize that the environmental movement has been co-opted by major international players. And so they're so clever, they've managed to get lots and lots of idealistic people to do their work for them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I've seen these idealistic people. They've got stars in their eyes. And God bless them. They think they're really doing humanity a favor.
Right.
You know? And they have no idea that they've been co-opted.
Well, this is a matter of education. I think if the word can get spread to these people, at least many of them will be very open to the truth. I would hope. I certainly am.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that the environmental movement was sold out, I appreciate you saying that. It's the first time I've heard that, and I think it's probably true. In other words, they took a movement which had some positives, and they just used it for their own...
Well, that's what Satan does over and over and over again. I mean, you know,
yeah.
Doesn't make any difference what it is.
They'll infiltrate any group and then turn it in that direction, in their direction, yeah.
Right.
Well, Joan, I imagine that your time is about...
I'm finished.
And we really do appreciate you taking the time to help inform our audience.
Let me give a plug for the women's group.
Okay, go ahead.
The women's group is a nonprofit organization that I started shortly after covering my first 17 meetings, when the cost became too much for me as an individual, my husband and I, to bear. We have books, we have videos. As I mentioned, you've heard a couple of the videos, World Government Connection, and our new one is 21st Century Feudalism. We have an information packet. We have newsletters. We have extensive newsletters. Go to our website, womensgroup.org, WOMENSGROUP, Women's Group, one word, womensgroup.org, or give us a call at 301-371-0541. We certainly can't do anything without your help. It becomes harder and harder to even do some of the things we do, but we are committed to helping people understand a very evil agenda that will steal, literally, our hearts, our minds, and our souls.
Well,
thank you so much, Joan, for all you're doing and for talking to us. I think what you're doing is really on the cutting edge, and we so appreciate it. I've been finding out many of the same things, and I know some of the things you're saying are going to be considered pretty way out there to a lot of our listeners, but I invite them to read your stuff and look at your videos.
Well, thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
All right.
Yeah, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Good night.